Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome to our Lift Every Voice book club. I'm Christine Walters Paintner, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this month's book club selection, which is this beautiful book, This Here Flesh by Cole Arthur Riley. And she's joined us today. And I also have, of course, my always wonderful conversation partner, Claudia Love Meyer. So Cole studied writing at the University of Pittsburgh and currently serves as the spiritual teacher in residence with Cornell University's Office of Spirituality and Meaning Making. She's also the creator of Black Liturgies, a space that integrates spiritual practice with Black emotion, Black literature, and the Black body, and a project of the Center for Dignity and Contemplation, where she serves as curator. So we're going to discuss her first book, This Here Flesh, Spirituality, Liberation, and the Stories That Make Us, which she describes as a book of contemplative storytelling and was an instant New York Times bestseller. So that's amazing, Cole, and congratulations and welcome. And we're so glad to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So Claudia, yeah, you want to jump right in?
Yeah. I hope congratulations as well. And I hope this is the first of many, many books. Your voice is needed in this world. Could you share a little about your spiritual journey and what inspired you to write This Here Flesh?
Sure. So I wasn't raised in an overtly religious home. In hindsight, I think of it as kind of, you know, vaguely spiritual. Most of that influenced from my grandmother, who was raised in a Seventh-day Adventist church, but it happened to be a pretty abusive place and an abusive situation. So she kind of left the church and didn't take, you know, my father's generation to any kind of organized religious service. But she had this faith in God and the divine, that I think was located in Christianity on some level, but also was curious and had a lot of mystery as well. But in my household, you know, yeah, I was raised by my dad, who was probably more agnostic, and a stepmother. And it wasn't until high school, really, that I started to ask some kind of deeper questions about, you know, what do I think is true? How do I think we got here? And all of these questions. And it felt at the time, probably mostly because of my own teenage ego and insecurity, like it needed to be this really grand intellectual pursuit to like find what was absolute truth or something. And so I read books on the 12 major world religions and tried to learn a lot, and eventually landed with a lot of curiosity and interest around Abrahamic faiths. And when I went to college, a friend of mine was like, let's go to church. And we did zero research and just went to the church right in the middle of campus, like the most obvious looking church, and like big red doors, stone building. We're like, we'll do this. And that was where I first kind of received like what a lot of people would consider like Orthodox Christian teaching. I don't necessarily hold that belief. I'm just using that language to kind of orient us. But yeah, since then, it's been a long journey of kind of yeah, integrating, like kind of clinging to the spirituality that my home possessed, which was grounded in things like Black dignity and storytelling and myth. I think like there was a lot of myth in my home growing up, and kind of magic that we like pass on to our children, these magical stories that everyone believes, that all of the kids believe. So it's been this journey of kind of clinging to that and trying not to wander too far from that like home, that spiritual home that feels significant to me, while also becoming curious about, you know, Christian traditions and liturgy and things like that. So what inspired me to write This Year of Flesh? I mean, my grandmother, I think this Year of Flesh is so much of her. I like can trace the plumb line back to her. She was a writer, a storyteller, and I've been interviewing people in my family, elders in my family, for two or three years at that point. And I was starting to see these threads between my story, my father's story, and my grandmother's story. And it was just like, when I went to write This Year of Flesh, I was like, I couldn't write anything else. Like, if there are any writers watching, you might resonate with this, where sometimes you plan, you know, in one direction, and the thing that's awake in you the most is the thing that wins often. And that was the stories of my family. So I integrated that with contemplative reflection.
Thank you. It's beautiful.
Yeah, Cole, you talk about in the preface, you know, what you're interested in reclaiming, this kind of contemplation or contemplative spirituality that's, you know, not just, not just something of the mind that's divorced from the body. And I wonder if you can say, because our community is really focused on reclaiming a contemplative spiritual practice in life, and this book club in particular is about expanding that vision so that we're reading this and expanding our awareness, not just through white voices, which obviously has been the traditional way of proceeding in terms of contemplative life. So just to maybe say a little bit more, you have this beautiful phrase about beholding the divine in all things. So I wonder if you can say a little bit more about what a contemplative spirituality looks like to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, I love that this is the concept of your book club. I think it's really just special and needed. I want to be a part of this book club. But yes, I had been kind of taught and formed in college to kind of think of contemplation as this purely intellectual pursuit. And at that time, you know, when you're young, I mean, I'm 32 now, but especially in your early 20s, and you're looking for some kind of belonging so desperately in those college years, you kind of, you do whatever you can to find some semblance of belonging. And for me, I thought, you know, in the arms of these white male academics, you know, I would find some sense of belonging, because I've always kind of been inclined to live in my head. I talk about this in the book some. I was a very shy child. I wasn't incredibly verbal. And so what people call the life of the mind, you know, that felt very natural to me. That felt very, very normal to me, almost as this safety zone that I leaned in so far into that I reduced contemplation to purely that, you know, this practice of the mind. And when I went to write this book and started talking to my grandmother and trying to piece together or kind of travel back, you know, that homecoming I'm talking about, like trying to come home to myself a little bit, I started to think, no, what does contemplation, what did that look like for us? What does that really look like in the body and mind of my grandmother? And, you know, Toni Morrison talks about this practice of imagination for the people who came before her, enslaved people, specifically enslaved ancestors, and this practice of imagination for their interior worlds. And I started to practice that and started to think, okay, what would a contemplative life had looked like for my ancestors who were enslaved? A lot of it had to be, you know, a project of the mind, because their bodies weren't given the liberty they deserved. and I don't want to say but, and also the liberation being a freedom in their bodies, a contemplative experience that's not devoid of their bodies, because that's the liberation we need it. That's the liberation we are desperate for, is this autonomy and agency. And so I don't want a contemplative spirituality that is divorced from my body, because what am I carrying on? You know, that what do I have access to that my ancestors didn't in their contemplative life? And that my ancestors would have, if you trace their line back to where it should be traced back to, which is pre-enslavement. If you trace back that embodied veneration and spirituality, I wanted to practice that. So to me, when I say contemplation or the contemplative life, is this, you know, fidelity to kind of beholding the divine in all things. I mean, that it can contain the mind, but also it contains the physical realm as well. You know, the barn swallows outside the window, or, you know, the way that, you know, my friend's hair falls on her face, or, you know, these very simple mundane moments, are we able to kind of locate something spiritual in them? Are we maybe not even that's probably not the best language, but are we able to see that that too is a spiritual, a spiritual moment, a spiritual interaction, and it's forming us. Yeah,
that's so beautiful. And you use the phrase a sacred attention in your part of your description, and I love that. It's a very your writing very much has the heart of a poet, you know, in terms of that, you know, being able to really pay attention to the moment and let that moment, you know, break open and see the divine, like, you know, flower forth from whatever it is that you're gazing upon. So, yeah.
Titus always thinks it's cuddle time when meeting. So Titus, but central to your work is the passage from Beloved when Baby Suggs is at the clearing, which is one of my all-time favorite passages of literature ever. Could you give us some context for that passage, what's happening, and tell us what it means to you?
Yes. We're kindred spirits in that way. So the clearing in Beloved, it's this sacred location. And there's this moment that I quote in This Here Flesh. And actually, the title is drawn from this moment as well, which I'm sure you've noticed. There's this scene where Baby Suggs, she has all her people gathered on the perimeter of this clearing, this kind of safe and sacred and secret place. And they're waiting at the in the trees on the perimeter, and she's on the rock and silent and having her own moment of contemplation maybe. And she says, who does she call first? You know, let the children come. And she says, you know, let your mother see you dance, and the kids dance. And she says, you know, let the men come, and let your wives see you laugh, and the men laugh. And she calls the woman to the center, and she says, cry for the living and the dead, just cry. And the woman, you know, they begin to wail. And she describes this really intergenerational, emotional, embodied moment. And she says, you know, they all get kind of caught up in each other until the women are dancing and the children are crying, and the men are crying, and the children are laughing. And there's all of this kind of this beautiful enmeshment happening until they collapse in the grass, tired, and they're resting and, you know, panting. And then Baby Suggs gives her sermon, this famous sermon that people often quote, and she says, in this here place, we flesh that lives, new breeze, flesh that dances on bare feet and grass, love it hard. And she goes into this beautiful poetry, I think, about the necessity of honoring yourself and of being aware of your dignity, the beauty of your face, the beauty of your neighbor's face. That moment, I mean, Beloved is my favorite. It's my favorite book of all time. It feels weird to say that because it's such a painful book. It feels inappropriate to put favorite, over it. But you know what I mean? Like I'm looking at my kindred spirit. It's like, you know, there's something in the spirituality of Beloved that mm-hmm. was so desperately lacking in my Christian formation in these traditional white dominated Christian spaces. And that is the intergenerational aspect, the embodiment, the mystery. And you know, actually Morrison, she writes that Baby Suggs doesn't tell them to go and sin no more. You know, this classic gospel message that everyone reduces gospel to. That's not Baby Suggs' gospel. It's this her gospel that she sensed the people needed was situated within dignity first instead of depravity first. And I think that, I mean, that is a radical kind of reclamation around spirituality and liberation of itself. So when I think about what kind of spiritual life I want to possess, it's the clearing. I want the spirituality of the clearing, the emotion, the embodiment, and the intergenerational connection.
Yes, I'm gonna really quickly read. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or to go and sin no more. She did not tell them they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek, or its glory bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine, that if they could not see it, they would not have it. Mm. Oh, good. So good. I mean, sadly though, Cole, this is where we came from. We went from our own spiritual traditions, our own vibrant spiritual traditions in Africa, to being captive in a strange land and unable to have the full expression of our spirituality, and sneaking off to the clearing and trying to tap back into our dignity and who we are. But it's getting lost now. I mean, people like you are saying, hey, no, let's not lose this. This is vital to who we are. We are different from traditional, from Africans who have never left Africa. We are also different from Americans in that we are the only people who had the experience of chattel slavery. And yet we are shifting our spirituality away from the clearing and emulating the larger Christian culture. And so I'm really glad to see you reclaiming Black dignity in our own spirituality, our very unique spirituality. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, in that chapter on dignity, I was really moved as well. When you talk about, I have a great interest in reclaiming contemplative life in part as an act of resistance against capitalism and productivity and all those, you know, perverted kind of, you know, sense of our own dignity and our own identity, I should say. And you have this beautiful, you know, image. You said we can't help but entwine our concept of dignity with how much a person can do. The sick, the elderly, the disabled, the neurodivergent, my sweet cousin on the autism spectrum, we tend to assign lesser social value to those whose doing cannot be enslaved in a given output. We should look to them as sacred guides out of the bondage of productivity, which I just absolutely loved. So tell us more about, you know, these, you know, beautiful souls that we have, you know, among us, these bodies that are not, you know, physically capable to keep up with the capitalist mentality, and how they can be these sacred guides for us. Because I'm all the way with you.
I mean, I write that from a place of like, yeah, of someone who has probably, you know, has probably perpetuated that capitalistic, utilitarian kind of brand of dignity of, oh, you've done this, you like, mm-hmm. You've accomplished this thing, you know, that's, I think I practice that. That's the air I breathe. And I think, you know, in academic places and in, you know, that's absolutely the air of like, how much can you retain, or, oh, you're so brilliant. And all of these patterns of hierarchy and uplifting that, you know, no one would articulate, you know, explicitly, but, you know, I was going to conferences, these faith and work conferences, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying that God exists in your work. I have a chapter of that in the book, and I think it's a meaningful thing to think about. I was going to these conferences where it felt like it was completely reduced. Spirituality was completely reduced to that of faith inside your work. These conferences with college students saying, you know, where's the divine in your calling? These vocational conferences, as if like choosing to be an engineer versus a nurse was, you know, the epitome of spiritual discernment. And I mean, I feel like I can criticize it so heavily because I participated in it, and I have so much, you know, regret for how much of my life I gave to those spaces. And when I was 26, I became really sick. Mm-hmm. And I am almost embarrassed to admit that it took that for me to be in proximity to people, to the disabled community, to people who, I mean, when I say I became sick, I mean, I was essentially in bed for a year, where, you know, I would go have any necessary meeting that day and then go back to bed. My husband was feeding me. It was this time of so much bodily uncertainty and bodily disconnect and aching. And it was when I first found myself really in intimacy and proximity to the disabled community and the chronically ill community, and was learning from them and undoing so much of what my own impressions of my dignity were. You know, I have issues with my eyes that make me a lot more prone to go blind. In brief, I'll say it that way. And, you know, I had to say, I'm not scared of going blind. I'm scared of being obsolete. And that confession leading me to places in myself. What do you think about this person, this support group that you have of, you know, people who have lost their sight? What do you really think of them? You know, because you're now confronted with that in yourself and your own self-image. So all that to say, it's been a journey of realizing that it's you know, not just the disabled community, it's, you know, the neurodivergent people, all kinds of people who refuse and do not fit in to what capitalism, and not just capitalism, this like unbridled, like the capitalism as a salvation, who just do not fit into that mold. They can show, they showed me how to live. They showed me how to lie there in the grass and still believe that I'm worth something, because it's beautiful to just be able to lie in the grass, you know? Yeah, I could go on. I could get very fired up thinking about how I used to think and how much I've been taught. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's so seductive, you know, especially when you have any capacity whatsoever to then channel that into, you know, that kind of affirmation that you usually get, that, you know, the sort of positive feedback loop of, oh, that, you know, is even when you're like Claudia, Love, and I both have, you know, autoimmune illness. We both suffer from migraines, and, you know, for me, it's been the last 30 years. So we're both pretty familiar with that landscape. And I know even living in that place, like there are times when I still, you know, get drawn back into that mentality very easily, you know, especially when I am feeling a bit better, you know, then it's like, oh, you know, how much can I get done? And there's nothing wrong, of course, with doing things, but I am very aware of just how seductive that is. And yeah, and I think we constantly need these reminders, especially from, you know, from the very people who, for whom it's not even a choice to be doing, you know, that's a reality that is, you know, it's a location of God's love and dignity as much as anything else, and probably even more, you know. Yeah. Thank you.
In chapter 6, you wrote about belonging, and you quote Dietrich Bonhoeffer, "In Christian community, everything depends on whether each individual is an indispensable link in a chain. Only when the smallest link is securely interlocked is the chain unbreakable." People who have been and continue to be oppressed and subjugated are often missing from the chain. The church is no exception to having these missing links, particularly in all white spaces of worship. So who's responsible for getting these links back on the chain? And once back on it, what makes these links secure?
And the question of who's responsible for getting, there's a lot in there. It's a very profound question because, I don't know if I have a clear answer to it. I think, we'll say responsibility, who's responsible for getting the missing links back in the chain. I think obviously, you know, those who possess traditional forms of power and agency in, you know, religious spaces, they really have some work to do in terms of what they need, in terms of sacrifice, in terms of killing their heroes, you know, so to speak, killing their darlings, almost as like a writer would say, that, you know, those things you love, those theologians you love who, you know, hated me, those Abraham Kuypers that you want me to read from when I know, you know, anyways, they have some work to do around, you know, killing their darlings, confessing, sacrificing, and decentering, that I think they're responsible for. But ultimately, I don't have a lot of, I'll put it this way. So then those who have been removed from the chain, those on the margins, if you want to kind of think about that, that biblical like way, the on the perimeters, you know, I think something special can happen with those missing links that almost doesn't require the responsible party to take responsibility, where they start to find each other and slowly and piece themselves together in this act of defiance and strength and say, you know, I'm not waiting. I'm not going to wait here as this solitary link for you to figure out why. I'm not waiting to belong to your space and to slowly integrate, because then you have to take one chain at a time and you're still in this dominated space and you know, oh, I'm coming to you and thank you for having me, as opposed to they start, you know, coming together. And then I think what happens is these people, this chain that refused these very necessary links, are going to slowly have to start to break off from what they think is the most significant thread, what they think is the most significant chain, and find their way in. They're find a way to integrate into spaces that are truly healing and truly inclusive. I guess that you could view that as a pessimistic view, but I think, you know, I'm a realist in that I haven't seen many spaces be willing to give up the power and disconnect long enough to find something truer and more beautiful. Like, I just haven't seen more, like, many spaces willing to do that. So to me, I kind of think, what are those disparate chains? What are those disparate links doing for themselves that there was little hope for in the greater chain, if that makes sense?
I love that. It kind of rejects a narrative of helplessness. I love that.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to kind of continue that thread of belonging, but look at what you write about in terms of place, because place obviously plays an important role throughout the book, because you write a lot about your relationship, particularly to the place where you live and, you know, just what you see around your home. And I love the insight about God making a home before God makes a thing, you know, not the fish first, but the sea, not the bird first, but the sky, not the human first, but the garden. I had never thought of it quite that way. And I absolutely loved that insight. So can you say more about how place forms us? And then also later in the book, you talk about this grief of being dislocated from the place of your ancestors. So kind of both that the belonging to place and the lack of belonging to place, and just how maybe you hold those together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, place is a chapter in the book that almost didn't exist. And then I just found myself unable, like it was, there's such a chasm where I feel like thoughts on place should go that were just implied throughout the book. But I think for me, I say this in the book, I think of like place being the one thing that always is, you know, like I've been without people, but you know, you're always located somewhere. You can't, we're not just, you know, heads floating around. And, but because of, you know, the progression of humanity, it's, you know, we're, and maybe survival, I don't know, to give us some understanding, some compassion, there is a increasing kind of self-centered and anthropomorphic, I think is the word, where everything becomes about humanity. You know, we are the most, humans are the most important. It's very important for us to say that over and over again. You know, we're the crowning Christians. I mean, it's like, we're the crown in creation. You know, we love that. And I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not really, but I think it's interesting that we are so concerned with it, of us being distinct and special, as if there's not some kind of specialty in plants and in the tree and in the ocean tides and the moons and the stars, you know. And so I've tried, you know, my best to be a person who cares deeply for the place I'm located, both to be a good steward of it, but also to understand that it's a steward of me, you know, it's protecting me. It's offering me nutrients. There's this connection and those moments. I mean, you talk about, you know, I talked about lying in the grass and just lying there, and you start to hear all these different aspects of nature come to life that don't require you, you know, in the grand in the grand timeline of the universe. You know, humans make up such a small part of it right now. We're like minuscule. Our existence is minuscule in the, you know, on the timeline. And yet I spend so much of my days thinking we're front and center, you know. And when people say we're destroying the earth, well, yeah, but like the earth is going to survive, we aren't. Humans survive, you know, but we think, anyways, and I think there's something kind of, yeah, defiant and that we can laugh at in that. There's so much resurrection in the earth, in our locations often, and also, you know, in these, in our communities and these places that we don't even want to have formed us sometimes. We're like, I don't want to believe I'm formed in this place, until you go home and you realize that there are things in yourself, you know, those old things that started long before you, that, you know, have everything to do with the environment that you were a part of. So I think it it's important on many levels, like the natural, but also these structures and these communities that we've made for ourselves, this awareness to place being no small part of our formation and hopefully our Christian formation.
You're muted, Christine.
I know, sorry. We have an arts festival going on outside the window, and it's a little too warm to close the window. So if you hear this music stirring in, it's just think of the thousands of people who are out there celebrating the creative arts, which is great in and of itself. Thank you for that. I have a special love of kind of honoring Earth. Actually, one of the books I wrote is Earth is Our Original Monastery, and that idea that everything that we learn. So I talk about Earth as our original cathedral, as the original saints, as the original spiritual directors, the original sacraments. And so this idea that everything we do in church, we actually learned from Earth herself or itself, or however you want it, whatever pronoun Earth wants. but that, you know, that sense that we emerge into this space, and you know, everything we do around liturgy, and you know, we learn from the rising and falling of the setting of the sun, and you know, from the create, you know, there's this wonderful, I live in Ireland for the last 10 years, and there's this wonderful kind of ancient tradition of the monks would have these deep kinship with animals. And so there's these wonderful stories about, you know, these animals being their teachers and their wisdom guides. And, you know, there's just, it's such a wonderful sense of, yeah, the place being alive and vibrant and, yeah, kind of forming us. So thank you for that.
That's beautiful.
Let's talk about wonder. We just had Makoto Fujimura on our book club. He's the last person we interview, and oh my God, we loved him so much. Well, we love everybody so much, but it was so good. And you quote him as saying, the most courageous thing we can do as a people is to behold. Christine also has a question from that chapter for you. So tell me the quote, the most courageous thing we can do as a people is to behold. What does that mean to you? And then Christine will have some questions about that for you as well.
Yes. I've learned so much from Mako Fujimura. So much. And his understanding of art and the role of the artist in salvation and liberation and in our connection to the divine completely transformed my life. He said that quote in this video that I watched of him and rewatch often. This courageous thing we can do as a people is to behold. And I think it's increasingly true. I heard that quote, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I think. And I think it's increasingly true because there's so much of, and I don't want to blame social media, I think, but the truth is, you know, the developments in our technologies have made it that we have, well, one, we have access to the terrors of the world with more urgency, with just more, everything's more speed, you know. It's like we have access to details, to images, to videos in a way that, you know, I mean, you think about teenagers and kids nowadays, like I didn't know what was happening, you know, in Myanmar when I was in high school. Now, some of that is really unfortunate and the like centering of the United States, but some of that is really protective. It's a lot to be confronted with all of that at once and confronted in a way that you just scroll past, you scroll and you might feel this pang, this something stir in you. And then you keep scrolling and you see something about Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. And then you scroll and you see a tragedy and kids have been shot. And then you scroll and then you see something, some advertisement, you know? And it's this form of knowing that is very quick and very dismissive, you know? And I'm not blaming anyone for participating in this. It's high level technology. They've spent a lot of money to try to make this as addictive and seductive as possible. And so you scroll and you're learning this form of beholding, whether it's beautiful or whether it's tragedy, that's on a whim and that you have control over. And so to spend time with something and to spend time really beholding something, I think is becoming increasingly rare. where, you know, our attention is becoming, you know, short, our attention span is becoming increasingly shortened, I've found, and a resistance to that, you know, the courage to look at a painting by Mako Fujimura and not rush over it in the name of, you know, productivity or addiction to technology or stimulation, you know, to really just sit and behold a thing. I think you hear things come awake in yourself. I'll speak for myself. I hear things come awake in me that I do not hear unless I take the time to pause. And I hear things in the voice of, you know, my sister, my friend, the face of my sister, my friend that I do not see, you know, or hear if I don't really pause and wait. And that waiting and that beholding, I think, Mako's teaching us wonderful ways of being in that one line alone. It takes courage to do that, to pause. Because who knows? I mean, it takes courage because you could hear something terrible. You could behold something terrible. Or you could behold something beautiful and feel so much guilt that you're not beholding something terrible, you know? And so there's a courage to remain even in the beauty because you think, am I dismissing? Am I neglecting? Am I doing enough? I was going to ask, like, have you two seen kind of a downward momentum toward the pausing, toward the beholding? Like, I'm thinking, like, my parents and my grandparents, there was just a lot of pause, a lot of moments where I'd be like, what are they doing? What are you looking at? And I don't see that so much, you know, in my generation. And have you seen a shift in that? And what do you make of that in terms of the spiritual?
I'll start. Definitely the world, I mean, there's so much access to information. And as you said, things to behold, way more access. That, you know, we didn't have the internet when I was a kid. We played outside when I was a kid. You know, my kids were inside playing video games. They played outside some, but there was this whole new thing with them that I didn't have as a child. And so, yeah, I definitely, you know, it's like the online, the world has ADD, you know, because information is just constantly coming at you. And I have a neurodivergent brain anyway, so it's always moving fast anyway. So one of the things that Mako told us to do that is now on my calendar is to take 2 hours every week to schedule 2 hours to do nothing. And whatever that doing nothing looks like, if it's hanging out with your kids or with your friends or you know, sitting under a tree. And I thought, you know, it was so simple and yet so profound too, in this very busy, driven world, to take time to just do nothing as a spiritual practice. So yes, there's definitely a sharp decline in contemplation. What do you think, Christine?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see it in the world. I see it in myself, you know, the addictiveness of scrolling through your feed. And, you know, I mean, there's some good things in there. And then, of course, you know, an hour later, you're like, you know, what just happened? Where was I? And what, you know, how has that enriched me? Or has it traumatized me? Or, you know, I ask those questions. And, you know, our whole work at Abbey of the Arts is really about helping people do exactly that, to pause, to be, to behold, to cultivate wonder, to look with eyes of the heart, to be still, you know, and to give people ways and specific practices and entry points in to do that, and to see it really as a liberating practice, which you write so beautifully about, that it really is healing ourselves, healing our culture, healing our relationships with our, you know, with our human community, but also our earth community. And and that, you know, it's like capitalism is obviously killing us all. And I feel like this, you know, this is my work, you know, the one small thing I can do to help counter that, you know, is to do that for myself and my own practice for sure, but also then to invite other people into that and give them ways simply to, yeah, I guess to hold the tension of a world that's full of terrible, horrible, you know, traumatic things, and a world full of beauty and wonder and joy and delight, and to be able to be present to both those, yeah, on the spectrum.
Yeah. When you mentioned capitalism again, I was thinking about like the kind of beholding that capitalism trains us in is one of ownership and like taking or like using, you know, we were at the pond with my nephew, the botanic gardens where I live with my nephew, and we were watching the turtles, and he said, can I take it home? You know, can you buy it for me? Can you take it home? And I said something that I've been thinking about since. I said, well, just because something's beautiful doesn't mean you need to own it. Mm-hmm. And I was saying it to, you know, a five-year-old. So that means I was really saying it to me, myself. He's like, what are you talking about? But in my mind, that temptation in us, it's like you see something beautiful and then we immediately draw ourselves to the center of the picture and think, what can I do? What agency can I have over this thing? Can I have it? Can I take it? Or and beholding, I think good beholding means you're capable of truly just beholding, not for what it can do for you or how it, you know, makes you feel even, or for how you're going to use it or pick it up or pluck it. But truly to just, it's I think it could be a really beautiful practice of decentering in a way.
I often use the image of kind of the grasping, you know, that so much of our culture is about grasping and seizing and, you know, owning and all of that, and like contemplative practice is about holding our hand open and letting it land and letting it fly off. You know what I mean? Like we don't have to hold on to it. We can simply be with it in that moment. So that's really beautiful. I want to get you to read a little bit from your book, because there's so much beautiful prose in here. And I wonder if you could read from the chapter in Lament on page 98, that where it starts, I am most disillusioned. And just I want you to go to the middle of 99. I don't know if that's too long, but that whole section is so such a gorgeous.
You won't believe I actually don't have my own book in front of me.
Do you want me to read it, or maybe Claudia Love can read it?
Well, either of you are welcome.
Yeah.
I don't have the physical book. I have it on my.
Okay. Well, then I'll read it. I wanted to.
And an audio book.
All right. I'll read the section. And I just thought it was really beautiful. So this is in your chapter on lament. I'm most disillusioned with the Christian faith when in the presence of a Christian who refuses to name the traumas of this world, I'm suspicious of anyone who can observe colonization, genocide, and decay in the world and not be stirred to lament in some way. For all the goodness of God, my ancestors were still abducted from their homes, raped and enslaved. I will not be rushed out of my sorrow for it. And we can delight that God made the garden with all those trees of fruit to feast on. But the earth is ailing and eroding from overconsumption and neglect. I shouldn't need to recite a litany of wounds and injustices and decay in order to justify my sadness. In lament, our task is never to convince someone of the brokenness of this world. It is to convince them of the world's worth in the first place. True lament is not born from that trite sentiment that the world is bad, but rather from a deep conviction that it is worthy of goodness. I'm going to stop there because I don't want to take up too much time with my voice. But that you talk about lament being this form of hope. And I just want to hear more, you say more about that, because I think it's a message that particularly church communities really need to hear.
Yeah, I think lament can be so scary for so many people, or threatening to some people, but because it seems like this antagonist toward God, you know, what are you saying about God? Or what are you saying about me? What are you saying about my ancestors, or, you know, my grandfather? And it's, you can hear the sadness, the practice of sadness in another person as this threat toward your own self-identity, or the identity of people you love, or the identity of God. And what I'm trying to explain is, I think, you know, if you don't have any expectation for goodness and beauty in the world, when you encounter something, you know, terrible or and tragic, it's not going to stir you in the same way, because you had no expectation for anything different. And so I'm trying to kind of locate for myself and others who struggle with this reality that sadness, that lament, and eventually that practice of lament, that is originating at the site of your belief that the world should be good and beautiful. You know, if we didn't believe that, you hear about, I don't want to go too off topic here, but, you know, early childhood trauma, I'm reading a book about that right now, and you hear about, you know, early people who experience early childhood trauma, and when they, kids who immediately come out of it, they can, they don't tend to cry all that often, and because their crying wasn't met with much, if it was a, you know, neglect situation, and it's very hard to stir them into, you know, a kind of emotional an expression of sadness, that is, it can be kind of a blankness almost. And I'm not a professional by any means. I've read 3 books, so I'll disclaim with that. But I think it's very interesting, you know, to observe how what you expect, if what you've been trained to expect from the world, you know, from the time you were born, you know, even if it's just is tragedy and disaster, when it comes, you have a little less of a response to it. Now, that's a very small example, but I think in general, you know, even kids, I have early childhood trauma, which is why I feel like I can speak this, not as an, not like I'm putting a spotlight on them, but I'm opening up myself a bit here. You know, as you grow up, you still experience beauty. So obviously that doesn't last, that doesn't last, that, you know, resistance to sadness, that inability to feel sadness. Usually most of us, if not all of us, on some level, believe, feel this internal belief and conviction around, you know, people shouldn't be harmed, you know, people shouldn't be harmed, people, you know, you shouldn't kill, you shouldn't destroy, you know, you shouldn't smash a flower just because you want to, you know, there are these things in us, this the protective nature of beauty and a belief in beauty and goodness that I think exists in all of us. And whenever I meet something that confronts that, even if I say, you know, the world is awful, you know, like young people do, I'm guilty of it. Inside, I'm saying that because I believe it's worth something better. You know, it's worthy of goodness. And so I that's a very long answer to your question, but I think that resistance to the sadness, to the lament, can be diffused a little bit when you explain, I'm not sitting here trying to just complain about how bad everything is. This is coming from a place of true hope that something should be that isn't yet.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think lament is such a integral, essential part of our work for justice and naming the things that need to change, but as you say, rooted in the sense of the beauty of the world and the hope that we have for something bigger and better. I can't believe that we're pretty much almost at the end of our time here. Claudia Love, did you want to say anything else before we wrap things up?
Just one little question.
Yeah.
Chapter 10, where you quoted Alice Walker to your friend and she recoiled, saying she would choose love over justice. Very briefly, how do you do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God?
It's a good question. Probably not that well. If I'm honest, probably not that well, but I'm thankful to have a community of people around me who are, you know, really honest. You know, they're not prone to flattery. And so they call me. I live a pretty secluded life right now, and have a pretty small circle, and they call me and call me out of myself in a way to say, what can you be doing? Okay, you've thought about this, you know, going back to kind of living in the mind, you've thought about this, you've written about this, and that matters. That can be an act of justice. But often I feel this lack of like, I want to do something else, you know. I want to write, and it takes a community of people who aren't like me and who have different justice inclinations than me, who have a lot more education and strategy around the community that I'm in, to really guide me to know what I should be doing when. So I follow the leadership of community organizers. I think that the best of us artists and community organizers, I think people yeah. who really understand what like how really are near to the pulse of a community. I think it's so remarkable. It requires so much. And so I really just try to do what they tell me to do. And then I have friends who like check in to make sure I'm connected to those community leaders. And then, you know, mercy and humility, I think, again, it's the life of the community that I'm in. It's not really, and I'm not being like falsely modest here or anything. Like, I truly don't know if I would be able to like cultivate that in myself without people around me that I have such an admiration for, who demonstrate humility and forgiveness and compassion, and who are so honest and we're so honest with each other. But at the same time, there's this culture of forgiveness and compassion that I think, you know, leads to self-compassion and is forming me, all that to say. So, yes.
That's all of us, really. And I like that you focus on have a community to guide you. So you've been delightful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Cole. This book, This Here Flesh, Spirituality, Liberation, and the Stories That Make Us, is a must read. And thank you so much for spending time with us. I feel like I could ask you loads more questions. So I'm going to have to just rest in that possibility for perhaps another time down the road. And just wishing you so much blessings on this book and any future work that you're working on. Thank you for being with us, Cole. It's a real privilege.
Thanks for having me.